Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Richard Slotkin. He's a cultural critic and historian. He's the Olin Professor of English and American Studies at Wesleyan University and the author of 8 books. His trilogy, Regeneration Through Violence, The Fatal Environment, and Gunfighter Nation is, I believe, one of the most important pieces of cultural criticism around. Thank you so much for being on the program.
Oh, you're quite welcome.
So I guess my first question is, for people who don't know this trilogy, let's just start off. What do you mean by regeneration through violence, and what are you saying in these massive and important books?
Okay, well, first I guess the most basic idea that I'm working with is this notion of the national myth. And the essential point is that when nation states are formed, they're political innovations, and particularly true of the United States, which originates as a series of European colonies 3,000 miles from home. And in order to give people who belong to the state a sense of being rooted in time, of having a common past, despite the fact that they represent various ethnic groups and regional and provincial groups, to give them a sense of a common identity and a common past, the people who form the nation state, that is the political leadership, will develop what I call a national myth, which is simply a story of how the nation came to be. Who was it who formed it? Who were the heroes, or the geniuses who brought the people together, like Moses for the children of Israel, and helped create the nation state? And for the United States, I guess the most obvious version of this is the myth of the Revolution and George Washington as the father of his country and so on. But in my work, I went back further than the Revolution. I went back to the original settlements, which is where the origin of American culture really is, in those first colonial settlements in the wilderness. And what I found was that the story that linked all of the different colonies, and remember that the colonies were, some were Catholic, some were Anglican, and others were various different Protestant sects originally, that what united them was this common theme of the conquest of the wilderness, that they were bringing Christianity and civilization to a savage wilderness inhabited only by Indians, as they would have called them, or savages. And at the very earliest period of this colonial history, they realized that if they wanted to expand their settlements in the New World, if they wanted to grow, they were going to have to fight the Native Americans for the land. And so that the original story of America's formation is the story of an Indian war. And because the colonies at this origin point were extraordinarily religious, most of them are Puritan, either explicitly or in their style of thinking, they think of this this social or political conquest of the wilderness in religious terms, as a regeneration or rebirth of the English spirit in the New World, as a kind of pathway to salvation. And the earliest stories that they tell are in the form of Indian captivity narratives, in which a woman who symbolizes the colony is captured by Indians and spiritually tested by these devils, as they think of the Indians, and her rescue, her redemption, is a rebirth and a reconstruction of the personality in American terms. And that was the origin of that concept, that that what the colonist imagines his history is a story of a transformation, a regeneration, or a rebirth through the violent conquest of the wilderness of the New World.
And one of the, I'm thinking a couple things. One of them is, as I was originally reading your books and then reading them again, I kept thinking about this line by Robert J. Lifton. He wrote The Nazi Doctors and many other books. And
yes,
one of the central things that I took away from a lot of his work is that before you can commit any atrocity, you have to convince yourself that what you are doing is not in fact an atrocity, but instead you are doing a good thing. The Nazis were not, in their own perspective, committing genocide, but they were purifying the Aryan nation or purifying the Aryan
right.
state.
Right. And, now, yeah, in American terms, the good deed that they're doing is rescuing their women and children from the menace of the Indian. And in doing that, they're also defeating the primitive and advancing the civilized or the modern, as we would call it. So, and they definitely give it at that very critical point of origin. It definitely has a Christian script to it, that it is the redemption of the soul, that by redeeming the captive from the Indians, you're redeeming a soul from the devil, so that there's a kind of spiritual development. What happens as you go forward in time and you move away from that period of almost uniform religious intensity, you get more secular versions of that same theme, in which you're making civilization, you're making the wilderness safe for democracy. You're making the wilderness safe for the new American democratic nation. As you move into the 19th century, not only the American democratic nation, but for economic progress of the most dramatic kind. First, agrarian development, the farms, but later technology, railroads, gold mines, coal mines, oil wells, the whole panoply of technology. And what this does is it writes this recurrence of the frontier theme all through American history. It comes right down to the present. I mean, you look at Star Trek and what is space? Space is the final frontier. What you have is this theme in which the American becomes American, becomes a wonderful, democratic, progressive being by putting down nature, by conquering nature and putting down the savage. And there's a racial script there, clearly. The Indians are defined as an alien people, an alien race. And throughout our history, we have found other races who stood in at different times for Indians in this script of conquest and progress. So you have Mexicans at one point during the expansion into the Southwest. You have Filipinos and Asians towards the end of the 19th century, and so on.
And, I mean, this may be too silly of a question, but so where does that racial component, where does that come from and go to?
Well, it comes from, if you look at the history of American development, what you have is the idea that and this again goes back to the fundamentals of American exceptionalism and the American myth, the idea is that in the old world, in Europe, the only way for one group of people or class to make progress is to do it at the expense of another class. So for the English middle class to rise, it's got to overthrow the aristocracy or displace the aristocracy and oppress the working class. And the American idea is different. What the American dream or the American myth of progress says is that the American progresses not by exploiting his fellow American, but by exploiting nature, by discovering new lands, by discovering new natural resources, and later on by discovering new technologies and new processes. What this story ignores is the fact that in order to get the land that was the basis of agricultural progress, you had to displace the Indians. You also, in half the country, agricultural progress required the enslavement, the importation and enslavement of Africans. So you have this story of progress in which, in fact, you are exploiting others, but you justify that by saying, well, they don't belong to the same species that we do. They're not white, and America is in its origins, Americans think of themselves as primarily a white republic, from which Indians and blacks can legitimately be excluded, and so it's legitimate to exploit blacks and Indians as if they were part of nature, not part of humanity, as if they were like livestock or trees or natural resources of any kind. And that's the core of the that's why racial difference is so fundamental to American ideas of social difference.
And this all ties, of course, to the exploitation of women as well, because I'm thinking about the sort of central notion of patriarchy, it seems to me, is, and this is a central notion of all racism too, is finding some way to differentiate self from other and then using that differentiation as an excuse for the exploitation of the other.
Yes. The women are an important symbol in the development of this racial script, of this racial idea, that it's your assumption about non-white humans is that, like women, they are there for the use of men. They are there to produce for men in certain ways. There are differences, however, in the way in which women function in this myth system and the ideology that's based on this mythological system. And that is that white women have an extraordinarily or symbolically privileged position. You justify the oppression of blacks, the enslavement of blacks, and later on the use of Jim Crow to keep blacks isolated within society, ostensibly to protect white women. You destroy the Native Americans, you destroy the Indians to protect white women from savage captivity and attack. So there is this peculiar duality in the way in which white women are treated within the system, and their symbolic importance works in both those ways.
So one of the things that I love about your work is the way you really seamlessly weave popular culture and historical movements is the wrong word, historical
yes.
something. And so can you give some examples of the themes that you've been talking about? And it could be the theme you just mentioned about women, or it could be the land theft, it could be the exploitation of the differentiation of Africans or Filipinos. And can you give some examples from film or popular literature that, I mean, that's one of the things that just absolutely blew me away about your work, is I'd be reading along about some historical, for lack of a better word, occurrences, and then you would throw in some just perfectly spot on examples from either popular literature or film that would show how mm-hmm. the popular literature or film was paving the way for the military exploitation.
Well, let me say, first of all, that the way in which you figure out or you establish that there is, in fact, a mythological pattern at work is by looking at a whole range of cultural productions. One movie or one novel or one history or one speech can't create a national myth. It's a pattern that you have to, before you can say you've found it, you have to say, I see it in dozens of places all at the same time. So in a sense, the interplay between studying the political ideology, political speeches, and popular ideas reflected in popular culture, that's how you figure out that what you've got is a myth. But to take an example, fairly current stuff, think of the way in which in the years after Vietnam, there was something called Vietnam Syndrome, a deep reluctance of Americans to imagine the country re-engaging in war in a serious way. You don't get a lot of war films made in this period. What you get is science fiction movies, movies like the Star Trek series, in which a federation of like a platoon, like an ethnic platoon from a World War II movie, representing Earth people, but we all know that it's like America's melting pot, against some enemy who is either super technological, like the Borg, or semi-savage, like the Klingons. And the Klingons actors are often played by non-whites. Gene Roddenberry actually said that he modeled the Klingons on a combination of the Apaches, who are the great villains of Western movies, and Mongol warlords. So there is in this movie, which is about the democracy called the Space Federation, a script in which us guys have to advance civilization against either super technological machines or against savages, and we're still out there on the frontier. A movie like Aliens, you're not allowed to hate other human races. We've now accepted that that's a bad thing. But in science fiction, your enemies are not human; they're bugs, they're insectoids, and so you can indulge in a fantasy of race war without actually having to pay, so to speak, the moral penalty of race war. And then if you compare a movie like Aliens with a movie like Black Hawk Down, in which you see that in Aliens, the insectoids come swarming through the channels of the space station to get the good guys. And the good guys are doing what? They're rescuing a little girl who's been, in a sense, a captive of the insectoids. So we're on a rescue mission, and the insects are crawling through the streets after us. And in Black Hawk Down, what are we doing? We're there to rescue the Somalis. We get into a fight instead, and the black people come crawling through the streets, swarming through the streets to get us and kill us and massacre us. And if you follow those two films, you can actually see close visual parallels in the way in which the ultimate shootout and the ultimate explosion that settles everything is set up. And if you take that scenario, rescuing the captive from the subhuman savages, you see the same script in Mary Rowlandson's Captivity narrative from 1682, and you see that script in Fenimore Cooper's Last of the Mohicans in 1826, and you see that in John Wayne and the Searchers in 1856, and you see it in Aliens in 1986, and you see it in Black Hawk Down in 2002.
And yeah, that's all fabulous stuff, and or horrific stuff, either however you want to look at it. And it another element that I remember specifically from the movie Last of the Mohicans, the Daniel Day-Lewis movie, was that,
yes.
I've seen this elsewhere, but I specifically remember watching that film and noticing that when a white person would die, their fellows would grieve. But often,
yes,
when one of the American Indians would die, there was a there would never be shown, or I don't recollect there being shown, that their loved ones,
yeah,
would grieve.
Yeah, yeah, it's particularly true in movies, because movies are a visual medium, but the contrasts of race, in the way in which the ways in which the different races act and the way in which their emotional lives are treated, it's very much a part of the vocabulary of cinema, but in the United States it goes back to this notion that that in American society, until really until the 1960s, there was a fundamental legal distinction in most of the country between white citizens and black citizens, and for most of the history before that, blacks did not belong to the body politic. They were not persons; they were property. And that's a kind of distinction that has sunk into the vocabulary of symbols, the language. That is what I call our national mythology, and it's very, very difficult to get beyond it.
There's ever since you you agreed to do the interview, there's been one thing I've been thinking, and I've conducted a lot of interviews in my life, and also been interviewed a bunch of times in my life, and mm-hmm. and I've never actually done this in interviews before, but I've been, so I'm a little bit nervous to try it, but I've been thinking this ever since you said yes, so I'm gonna try it, and I hope it works out. Which is, I don't know if this happens to you, but when I read a book, and then the book, when I read a book and then it's 10 years later, oftentimes there is one message that comes through, and there's one thing I remember. It's like somebody says, so what was Gunfighter Nation about? You know, I don't give them 800 pages worth. I usually give them 2 sentences worth. And it's the same with my own books, of course. And something that I've never done on air before, but I want to try, is I want to tell you what, like, is the one sentence synopsis that I got, and then you can tell me whether that was secondary, tertiary, whatever.
All right, go ahead.
When somebody says, so what was this, what was Gunfighter Nation about? One of the things I say is that one of the images I took from the whole trilogy was that part of the central stories that we see again and again, and this was life changing for me. This is one of the reasons that I say that I love your book so much, is that one of the central stories of this culture is that we always want to fight fair, but the other side fights dirty. So just this one time only, we got to fight dirty because they're so bad.
Yes. Right.
And so was that primary, secondary, tertiary when you were writing it? You know, where did that fall in the sort of hierarchy of how important your ideas were in the book?
I think that's one of the primary themes. Not the only one, but I think it is one of the primary themes. It goes back to how the myth works. The myth works by creating a hero who has to have a kind of plausible personality and emotional life. And the heroes in America, of this frontier myth are guys who stand on the border between two orders, between savagery, let's call it, and civilization, between Indians and whites. And the reason that they're the hero is that they can, I call it the white man who knows Indians. He can beat the Indians because he knows how they work. He knows how to think like them. And he knows how to think like them because he's attracted to them. He's drawn to what in Star Wars is called the dark side of the Force. So that the central story always involves the hero going to the dark side, the hero fighting like an Indian, the hero borrowing some technique from the enemy that he has to use in order to defeat the enemy. And in so doing, he compromises himself. He's not like Superman, who never compromises himself. He's a human being who and a tragic figure in many ways, who does compromise himself in order to save the world for the rest of us. So he learns to fight dirty. And you can see this again if you want to take it up to the present. One of the more modern and more interesting versions of this story is what I call the platoon movie. And this really dates from the Second World War. And it takes all of these elements of the frontier story that I've been talking about, that the American defines himself in combat against the savage enemy for whom he's trying to save civilization. It dates from the Second World War. And the difference in the platoon movie is that instead of a white man or a group of white men, the ethnic platoon is ethnically and even racially mixed, representing America as a multi-ethnic, multi-racial society for the first time in American history. And that really starts in 1943. Now, how does this multi-racial platoon work? How does this new model, American nation, come together? They come together in the face of an enemy who is more alien than any of the constituent elements of the platoon, the Japanese or the Nazis in World War II. The Japanese and the Nazis fight dirty. In order to beat them, that is to say, they fight in a way which is cruel and unscrupulous. Let's put it that way. In order to beat them, we have to fight that way. We even have to learn to hate the way they hate us. And so the paradox of this new version of the multiracial America is that the fire that melts the constituents of the melting pot, it's hatred of an external enemy, and learning to fight dirty like that enemy. And if you play this out politically, it can be a justification for doing immoral things in the name of the national interest. The enemy tortures, so we have to torture. The enemy does covert operations to destroy us. We have to do covert operations to destroy them.
And one of the things that I remember reading, I don't remember which book it was, but I remember reading a book by Norman Solomon. He does a lot of media, accuracy media stuff. And I remember reading about 1990 or so, about the time that Manuel Noriega went from being a favorite to a unfavorite of the United States. And I happened to read a section where they talked about how if a dictator is liked by the United States, he's called the president. And if he's not liked by the United States, he's called the strong man. And then that afternoon, I was teaching Eastern Washington University at the time. And that afternoon, I was driving home from work, listening to NPR, and they started talking about Manuel Noriega, the Panamanian strongman. And I had just read it that day. And so it affected me so strongly, I had to pull over to the side of the road and just think for a minute. It's like, and I keep coming back to, you know, how what your books have done for me, in part because it was one of those things where I never, you know, that image that I said of what we want to fight fair, but we have to fight dirty because of them. That was one of those things that I hadn't made that connection, but then I read your books and I saw it everywhere. It's like it's the Dirty Harry movies, United States. And another thing about this that's really crucial, I think, is always the implication that we, the good people, are only going to do this terrible thing, fight in a cruel and unscrupulous way, just this once. And so we can convince ourselves that even though the United States used torture rampantly in the invasion of the Philippines, that we can still convince ourselves that enhanced interrogation techniques are a brand new thing. And it's just this once. And that's part of it too. And I even see that in personal relationships, like abusive relationships, where the abuser is convinced that, you know, just this once we have to have this abusive incident because.
Right.
And so it just the power of that image of the one time because of you, just it strikes me as really ubiquitous within. No, it's not ubiquitous. It's too strong. But it strikes me as something that can be seen in movie after. We can be seen, you know, almost everywhere we look.
Yes, I think that though that the pretense of the story and the way that the story is being told is that this extraordinary, let's call it an extraordinary act of violence. Thanks. This extraordinary act of violence only has to be done once because it's a special occasion. We wouldn't do it if it weren't an extraordinary occasion. But once you take that that story and you put it out as story, then it's more than just an incident. Then it's a model for imagining ways to deal with similar problems. One of the things about myth is it's not simply a story about the past. It's a story that's meant to be used. The hero stories from the past are supposed to provide us with models for how we deal with a crisis in the present. So, for example, you have to take two sort of recent incidents. You have Richard Nixon prepping himself for the confrontations of Watergate by watching Patton over and over again, seeing how the story of a strong man can provide him with a model for how to behave in a crisis. Or George W. Bush, before invading Iraq, watches Black Hawk Down over and over to get because to him there's a message in there for how to handle a crisis rightly and how to handle. In his case, he saw the movie as a mistake. We withdrew from Somalia, and that showed us we were weak, and that was the lesson he took from that movie. So once you put the story out there, even though it's the story of an extraordinary crisis, it's out there and it serves as a model. One of the things I argue, I've written a lot about lynching in particularly in the period between the Civil War and 1925 in the United States. And there's a lot of fiction about lynching. The most notable would be Thomas Dixon's novel The Klansman, that was the basis of the movie Birth of a Nation. But there's a lot of such stories and novels about lynching. And every one of these stories represents the lynching as something extraordinary, in response to an extraordinary crisis. And yet the net effect is to say that the way we responded to this extraordinary crisis is a lesson to us about how we must meet similar crises in the future. And it's also a lesson to the groups against whom the story is directed, what they can expect from us if they get out of line. So even though it's the story of something exceptional, once it becomes a story, it's not an exception, it's an example which can be used, and it's meant to be an example, it can be cited in a variety of circumstances.
So let's go back to sort of the definition of mythology, the
right.
definition for this conversation of mythology, and
right.
how you were saying that, you know, you can have one story that goes in an entirely different direction, but that doesn't make the mythology. The mythology comes from the sort of looking at the whole of the sort of general movement. It's like in a river. You can have eddies that go another direction, but generally the current
yes.
is one direction.
And right.
one of the ways I think about that also is that not only do these stories, as you just said, create the model, but in addition, the culture, only the stories that fit within the cultural model will generally gain huge acceptance. And one of the ways I think about this is that the music of Jimi Hendrix would probably not have worked in the 1920s because the
right.
culture wasn't ready for it. And
right.
so having to do with this, how do we, if we recognize that that this model, I mean, I perceive the model you're describing as incredibly destructive.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, the mythology as destructive.
Yes.
And so how do we, I don't know. The thing I'm thinking is that so many indigenous people have said to me is the first and most important thing that we have to do is to decolonize our hearts and minds. And
yes.
what I'm trying to get at here is, so it seems to me that that you have provided a really important first step toward demythologizing this mythology by naming it.
Yes.
And now what do we do on a large scale? I'll ask personally in a second. On a large scale, what do we do now that we recognize this mythology? How do we change it? What do we do?
Well, that's a huge question. I think there are a few things that one has to do. One of them is, as you said, to name it, to analyze it, to expose it as what it is. I mean, one of the reasons why mythology works the way it does is that it's accepted as normative. It's accepted as a given. It's not simply, it's not a racist story. It's simply a story of the way things were and had to be. Excuse me.
Just a second.
So one thing is to call it out as what it is, that it's an artificial construct of a historical series of historical events which could be interpreted in a different way if seen from a different point of view. That's one way to handle it. Another way which artists have found to handle it is to work through the language to undo the language. A good example of that is a book like Huckleberry Finn, where we have Huck Finn. It's a book that hinges on the N-word. And Huck is someone for whom that word defines black people. And yet, though he continues to use that word and to think in those terms, his experiences with Jim going down the river and with slavery going down the river discredit the original meanings that he attaches to that word. It undoes it. And it puts him in a place where he can't, at the end of the book, he can't entirely give up that way of thinking. He was still raised in that culture. But the reader who has followed him through says, oh, God, Huck, why can't you make the final? You've made every step but the last one. Why can't you make the last one? And by saying that to Huck in imagination, you're in a sense saying, I've made the last step. A similar case would be, although I think some people disagree with this, John Ford's The Searchers, in which starts out with a racist as the hero, John Wayne's character of Ethan Edwards, and it undoes him, and it undoes his values through the course of the film. It goes from Indian hating to something very different from that. And that's another way to do it. The problem with both of those two things, which I just said, is that the power of the myth is such that every retelling, in some ways, reinforces it. Criticism can do something to unmask it, but it also points to the attractiveness of the story. And of course, the artful treatment reiterates the terms of the story. So the third thing, where we have less control, is that societies do change. And when they change, either the mythology and the ideology that governs the society adapts to the new circumstances, or the society explodes. And what's happened in the United States and what happened in the 20th century is that a mythology which represented the United States as a white man's republic was seriously modified, coming really out of the Second World War, and it wasn't simply a white man's republic, it was a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant man's republic, to make it now a nation of immigrants, a nation of ethnics, of hyphenated Americans, and a nation in which non-whites of a huge variety are now much more centrally included in our understanding of what it means to be an American. Now, I don't want to sound like Pollyanna here, because it's perfectly clear from the rhetoric of the two Obama campaigns that for a lot of white America, non-white Americans are not real Americans. And ethnic Americans are not real Americans. So there is still that strain in our society. But the change from when I was growing up is phenomenal. I was born in 1942, really came to consciousness in the late 40s and the 1950s. And white supremacy, the language of white supremacy, was the language. It wasn't marginalized. It was mainstream. You had either nice white supremacy or not so nice white supremacy, tolerant white supremacy or intolerant white supremacy. And now white supremacy has to apologize for itself in this country. To me, that's huge. And it's made a difference in the stories that we tell. The difference is that characters who used to be excluded from the story or marginalized within the story are now brought into the center of the story. And I'll give you, to give you the sense of what the strength of that and the limits of that, take the role of women. In the national myth, the warrior is the key figure. The Indian fighter, the hunter, is the key figure, and the key figure is always male. If you look at recent cinema, recent science fiction starting in the 80s, you get a film like Aliens, where Ripley, the woman, is the white man who knows Indians. She is the Hawkeye type hero. It's now possible for women to have that role, and for non-whites to have that role. So there's that change, that inclusion is now there. But the story structure in which the new people are acting isn't different enough from the old story. It's still the story of this kind of race war on the border.
Years and years ago, probably 13, 14, oh my gosh, maybe 15, 16, 17 years ago now, I interviewed George Gerbner. Do you know his work?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, he was the TV violence guy.
Oh, yes. Okay, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And I loved interviewing. He was great. And one of the things he said is that everybody misinterprets his work, that his big deal wasn't how much violence there is on TV, although he did have something to say about that. But the bigger deal, he thought, is the question, and I'm just saying this to validate what you just said, his question is always who does what to whom, that violence is a social
right.
relationship. And so what he's really interested in, which not many people wanted to talk about, he said, is the percentage of violence that's done by white males. He said, this is how you, quote, create minorities. This is how you create subservience, is by showing in the media all the time that white males win every conflict.
Right.
And they do so, to use your word, using the gun.
Right.
Go ahead.
So if you change that story, if you take that same script and you put a black man in the lead role, which has been done, or an Asian man in that role, which has been done, or a woman in that role, which has been done, you do change the mythology of power. You say, yes, these peoples who once are considered marginal or subordinate now can act as the center, the representatives of the center, the representatives of the state. But the action that they engage in still follows the same pattern. And we recognize that they're heroes because they have the same kinds of enemies that the white Anglo-Saxon Protestant male frontiersmen had.
Well, and this leads to a problem, too. And we've only got a few minutes left, so this is a huge topic. But this leads to a problem, too, that you talked about in Gunfighter Nation with the Wild Bunch, where they choose. I don't remember your exact language, but basically you say that they choose the gun over over democracy.
Right.
That leads to, when you correlate that, which is once again one of the things I love about the book, you correlate that to U.S. foreign policy in Vietnam. And instead of me just sort of hemming and hawing about that, maybe you can talk about that also changing the story. And I don't mean to be Pollyannish. I'm certainly not Pollyannish about democracy or nonviolence working in every circumstance. But can you talk about changing that the larger story too?
Well, yeah. I mean, that would be an example. I parallels with what I said about Huckleberry Finn earlier, that in Wild Bunch, you have the movie plays with these notions of what is it that justifies violence. Violence in the name of a democratic revolution is superior to violence in the name of repressing that democratic revolution. And then the question is, where do the and this is all taking place in Mexico. The question is, where do the Americans fit in, and how do they act? And the irony at the heart of the film is that the Americans end up, after playing both sides, they end up fighting for the democratic revolution of the Mexican peasantry for all the wrong reasons. Not because they're Democrats, but because they're proud gunfighters and they've been humiliated by the Mexican warlord, and because they're loyal gang members, they have loyalty to each other, and one of their own has been tortured by the Mexican warlord. When you tell the story in that way, you expose the fact that that in the American story, that violence has its own, it's almost its own justification. It's almost a good in itself. Violence is what makes the hero, and it makes him a hero no matter what cause he's fighting for, or no matter what reasons he has for fighting. And that shows the irrationality of the story. Shows it in the classic Greek manner by playing out a tragedy.
So basically, we've got like a minute left. So
okay.
I know that we've. I mean, this has been, I think, a really intense. This will be a really intense experience for a lot of readers. And I'm sorry to even ask this, but so, you know, if you could. What would you want readers to take, listeners to this, to take away? You know, it's like, wow, I heard this great interview today, and what was it about? You know, what would be the take-home point that you want for people to really grasp?
I guess it's that they should get the sense that this story of American exceptionalism that we're so proud of depends on a set of illusions and a cruel illusion the illusion that you can gain, make economic progress simply by exploiting nature without cost to your fellow human beings, and that's what we do. That's how Americans make progress, when in fact we exploit labor all the time. And the second thing is that American history is the story of is a violent story in which, in the name of various kinds of ideals, we have killed, dispossessed, and oppressed Native Americans, blacks, and others who got in the way of this drive for wealth and progress.
Well, thank you so much for your work, and thank you for being on the program.
And thank you for asking me.
Oh, gosh, thank you. And I would like to thank people for listening. My guest today has been Richard Slotkin. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.